You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with the Wisconsin author of Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip, and share our favorite memories from the old station wagon. Now, Republicans in the state Senate met yesterday to talk about the budget, and the first vote on the plan is expected to come in the assembly by early next week. On Monday, we talked to a Republican on the legislature's budget writing committee about what made it into the budget and what didn't. Today, we hear from one of the committee's Democratic members. State Senator John Erpenbach represents Wisconsin's 27th Senate District, which includes Baraboo, Mount Horeb, and Belleville. Senator Erpenbach, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, before we get into some of the details in this joint finance budget, big picture, what are your reactions to what came through the committee?
Disappointment. A lot of missed opportunities to work with Governor Evers on K-12 funding, on special education funding, UW system funding, and certainly transportation. And the Republicans never took the governor up on his offers to sit down and talk about their differences. So missed opportunities, and in the end, the results are pretty disappointing.
By and large, though, for those issues you just mentioned, Republicans are increasing funding for education, Medicaid or health care coverage and transportation, just not as much as the governor was looking for. Is this a happy middle ground compromise?
Oh, no, not even close. I mean, when you cut special education funding by about 60 or 70%, which is what they did, and you cut the recommendations from Governor Evers on K-12 funding, which is what they did, that's not a good thing. I mean, the priority of the budget should be and always should be, basically, is making sure that our kids have opportunities no matter what part of the state they live in. And the budget that the governor introduced was balanced. They might not have liked the way it was balanced, but it was. And on transportation, you know, the idea of increasing basic, you know, registration fees and so on, rather than increasing the gas tax, just lets out-of-state drivers off the hook. So, yeah, the Republicans increased it more, but they didn't. I don't think they had a choice in that area, but certainly not nearly what it should have been.
Let's get to one of the ways the governor had hoped to pay for some of his budget increases, accepting federal help for Medicaid. What do you think about the decision of Joint Finance not to agree with the governor on that one?
I think it's probably one of the more irresponsible financial decisions I think I've seen Republicans make since I've been in office. And I'm not saying that to exaggerate, because here's the deal. The way the governor had it proposed is you take the Medicaid expansion, which means you cover people up to 100%, 138% of federal poverty level with Badger Care. If you do that, we save $324 million right off the bat of state money. We also leverage about $1.4 billion in more federal funding coming to the state to go into all sorts of other types of programs. And that's, you know, when we talk about federal money, let's make no mistake about that. That's Wisconsin taxpayers' money that we send out to Washington, and Washington is basically saying, here, take it back. And by saying no, the Republicans had to spend about an additional $300 million of just general tax revenue that could have gone to schools, that could have gone to anywhere else. They're spending that to say no to that $1.4 billion, which is, you know, just ridiculous. They have no excuses for doing it. But, again, it's a situation where they view Badger Care, for example, covering low-income folks with health care as welfare. Well, it's not. I mean, these are people who are making, you know, $8 an hour. And there are people out there. There's about 80,000 people out there would have been covered by this. But yeah, it was a financially irresponsible thing to do, especially when you're cutting K-12 education based on what the governor wanted to fund, cutting special education based on what the governor wanted to fund, in order to spend that money on Medicaid so you don't have to take the $1.4 billion.
They raised concerns that taking this federal Medicaid money would put more people on Medicaid reimbursements that can be low for a lot of health care providers. They raised concerns that this is going to hurt health care providers in Wisconsin, switching people, say, from the marketplace to Badger Care.
Well, it actually doesn't. And there are going to be people there. There's probably about, the numbers are basically saying there's about 82,000 people the expansion would have covered. About 40,000 of those people are in and out of the marketplace, depending on their financial situation. So, in other words, some of them are uninsured and still walking into emergency rooms with no way to recover any of that money. So, at the very least, what you would be doing is people would be walking in with Badger Care. So, you do have some coverage in that. But again, the idea that they're not taking this because it might hurt the providers. The providers have to provide no matter what. I would tend to think the providers want to be reimbursed something as opposed to nothing in certain cases. And that's, again, by saying no to the Medicaid expansion, that's what the Republicans are doing.
Talking to State Senator John Erpenbach on the Joint Finance Committee about the budget plan that passed with the Republican majority on that committee. On the how to pay for things side of things, both the Joint Finance Plan and the governor's plan involved some tax cuts. The governor had hoped to pay for more tax cuts at the lower and middle ends by cutting a manufacturing tax credit. That didn't end up happening. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's in there basically to give some of the more wealthy people of Wisconsin a tax break. Now, these are people who create jobs. But the studies have shown year after year that the manufacturers and ag tax break that's out there doesn't produce the jobs, not nearly, and close to what Republicans thought they would do. So rather than kind of roll some of that money back and spread it out over, load it to middle-income taxpayers here in the state of Wisconsin, the Republicans kept that multi-millionaire tax break in there, and in the end, that's what it is. I mean, it's a tax break for people who make a lot of money. But the governor was right to basically cap the manufacturing part of that tax break, and he took that money and plowed it into K-12 education, and special education also helped provide a tax break for middle-class tax break for Wisconsinites. But not doing what the governor recommended, meaning means the Republicans had to spend more money in other places that we didn't have to had they taken the governor's recommendation from the get-go.
This is past joint finance. Now, of course, it would have to go through the full assembly, then the Senate before going to the governor. Do you see room for changes in the full chambers?
I think, actually, it may have to change in the Senate. I don't know if there's enough votes as it is right now to pass in the Senate. So I expect it to change a little bit, but I really hope the Republican leadership takes the governor up on his offer and sit down and talk about the differences rather than just putting a document on his desk. That would be very hard to not partially veto just about all of it. Because again, if you take a look at what the governor requested, he's not getting a lot of what he requested. You know, just transportation alone, the way the Republicans have it set up, it's not fair. It's simply not fair. Out of state drivers are off the hook when it comes to paying increases gas taxes in this state, and Wisconsinites have to foot the bill for everything else. So right there, that's not fair, and it's something that I know the governor doesn't really appreciate. So I expect it to change between now and the time it gets to his desk. To what degree depends on whether or not the Republicans are willing to talk to a Democratic governor about the differences.
Briefly, as we wrap up, some of your colleagues have raised concerns about environmental aspects and conservation aspects in the budget. Anything there you'd want to highlight?
The governor early on in his term basically claimed this year as the year of clean water in Wisconsin. And when it comes to the CAFOs or the large factory farms and trying to make sure that not only are they're regulated, but there are penalties in place in case they violate regulations out there, that could have been substantially stronger than it is as it stands right now. So just that issue alone was pretty frustrating to deal with. But we have to clean up our water. We need to do a lot more to make sure that we're dealing with the lead laterals in certain parts of Wisconsin. And we also have to deal with our well water. I mean, our groundwater is becoming contaminated, and the Republicans, I don't think, moved the needle too much in the direction of clean water. So that was frustrating.
Senator Erpenbach, thanks for joining us today.
All right, anytime.
That was State Senator John Erpenbach, who represents Wisconsin's 27th Senate District, including Baraboo, Mount Horeb, and Belleville. He's also a member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, and he joined us today to talk about his reaction to the latest version of the state budget. It was approved last week by the committee's Republican majority. Coming up, we talk to a Milwaukee photographer who's trying to keep a Civil War-era style of photography alive. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen, who explores the meanings behind all the symbols on the Wisconsin state flag.
We've received many listener questions through WPR's Wisconsin Project. And as we combed through them, we flagged a particular question. It came from Xander, a fourth grader at Mineral Point Elementary School.
Hi, my name is Xander. What do the symbols mean on the Wisconsin flag?
So to help us decipher all the symbols on the Wisconsin state flag, and there are plenty of them, I spoke with Matt Blessing. He's the director of collections at the Library and Archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
So the Wisconsin state flag, like a lot of other state flags, was actually adopted in 1913. The main body of the flag is sort of a navy blue. Blue represents traits like wisdom, trust, truth. But in 1913, what was really important was blue represented loyalty. When you look at the elements of the state flag, at the very top of the design, you have the state's motto, Forward. Beneath Forward is a relatively small badger. You have a miner. That's a reflection of early Wisconsin history and lead and zinc mining in the Driftless area, copper mining in northern Wisconsin. And it's a tribute to Wisconsin's workers. And across from the miner on the left-hand side, you have a sailor. And between them is a golden seal that has symbols of four different trades: navigation, manufacturing, mining, and agriculture. And then smack in the middle of the golden shield is a small red, white, and blue coat of arms. And surrounding that coat of arms is the national motto, E Pluribus Unum, one out of many, a recognition of our role in the larger nation.
And then right below the miner, we see a stack of 13, what are those, lead bars?
Right. Directly beneath the miner is a pyramid stack of lead ingots. And that, again, is a little bit of mining history, a little bit economic boosterism about the state's mineral resources. But 13 is important because it's representative of the 13 original colonies.
And then next to the lead ingots, we can see everyone's favorite horn of plenty, the cornucopia.
Right. That's, of course, central to have a cornucopia about Wisconsin's agricultural history. So overflowing out of that cornucopia, you have grapes, apples, and what look like oranges. Now, I don't think oranges have ever grown in Wisconsin, so that might be something that needs to be corrected.
So I'm no Marie Kondo, but to my eye, it looks a bit cluttered. I might call it the Sergeant Peppers of state flags, yeah?
It's a little busy. To the modern eye, I think a lot of 21st century people gravitate to simplicity, which is sort of a central element in a lot of flags that attract people. But there aren't as many teaching opportunities with those flags as what you have in Wisconsin. So I still like it. I'm biased because I'm an archivist and a historian. I think we're fortunate to have a flag that we can be proud of and really be used as a teaching tool in Wisconsin schools.
That was Matt Blessing, Director of Collections at the Library and Archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Submit your own Wisconsin question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now, while many people have left behind film cameras and even digital camera sales have steeply declined, a Milwaukee artist is revisiting a photography style much older and much less portable than those we're familiar with today. She's been taking portraits of Milwaukee residents, visitors, bands, even wedding and pregnancy photos for a few years now, reviving the technique known as tintype photography, popularized back in the 1850s. Margaret Musa is a Milwaukee-based wet plate photographer. She was the 2017-2018 Artist-in-Residence at the Pfister Hotel and now has her own studio space where she takes tintype photographs. Margaret joins us from our Milwaukee studio. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, how did you get into this particular type of photography?
I actually read an article about this process, and I was not a photographer at all, but something about this article describing how you could still take a photograph the way that they did during the Civil War just made me want to learn. And I ended up going to New York to take a workshop on the process, and I've been doing it ever since.
Now, if I were to sit for a portrait with you, what is my experience? What happens? It's not just a quick snap of a picture.
No, it's not. It takes me at about the fastest I can go is taking one picture every 15 minutes. So for my subject, if we're outside, that does mean that you would have to hold still for a few seconds or longer, depending on the light. But at my studio, I have strobes, so I can capture children and even pets in literally just a flash. So it's pretty easy for the subject under that light.
And tell us a little bit about the technology. What are you doing to take this image?
Well, it starts with a metal or glass plate that I coat with an emulsion called collodion. And then the emulsion on the plate becomes light sensitive after I dip the whole plate into a bath of silver nitrate for a few minutes. And then after it's been sensitized in that bath, I load it directly into the back of my large format camera, expose the plate, and then I actually have to develop the plate while the chemistry is still wet. So it's called the wet plate process because everything, development and all, has to happen while the chemistry is wet.
And what that makes me think, you know, the way I take pictures, apart from badly, is, you know, take lots of them, hope one of them comes out. The kind of effort it takes to make this one image has got to, I don't know, it's got to change the way you think about what you're doing. What, as an artist, what is going through your mind as you're catching that image?
It's slow. A lot of people are, you know, I get a lot of questions like, do I really only get one shot? And I mean, I definitely take my time for the image, every single one. And, you know, it's depending on how you look at it, it's a slow process or it's really fast. I mean, by the time we set out to make the image, we're looking at it in less than 10 minutes, and that's pretty magic.
And I looked at some of the images you have up on your website, and it's really interesting. I mean, these are clearly modern-day people, but in this, we've seen those 1850s, 1860s Civil War era tintypes, and it looks very historical at the same time. How would you describe the end result of the images you take?
Yeah, this process sees something a little bit different,
yeah.
And that's a result of not only the camera, which is, you know, I use old cameras. A lot of the cameras I have are from the early 1900s with giant brass lenses on them. And this type of camera, large format, has the bellows in the center, and that a camera like that has a really dramatic effect on focus. So that means I can get someone's eyes in like the clearest, sharpest focus. And then, you know, anything like a foot behind them starts to blur into the background, which is a really dramatic and kind of romantic effect. But then furthermore, the chemical process leaves sometimes certain artifacts around the edges. You know, my fingerprints are kind of just there in the corners of all the plates that I make. A fleck of dust that might be on the emulsion could cause a little comet across the plate. So it's really kind of cool, the things that show up.
Talking to Margaret Musa about her tintype or wet plate photography. She's an artist based in Milwaukee. Margaret, the final product, I would walk away with a piece of tin, right, with the image on it. I'd have this metal sheet.
Yeah, that's right. There are no negatives in this process. So each image is a direct positive exposed directly onto a metal plate.
And how hard was this to get good at?
I'm still trying to get good at it. I say I've been doing this for almost 5 years, and I'm learning all the time. I still come across issues that I don't understand, and there aren't a lot of people that can help. So really, you know, in the end, it's just up to me to figure out figure this process out, and that's what really holds my interest in doing this forever, really. I love it. It's a challenge, and it's really fun.
And an artistic product you're involved in caught our eye here. You and I believe your sister are getting ready to start this unique sort of studio environment in an Old West ghost town?
That's right. My oldest sister is the only person that lives in a town called Cisco out in Utah, which is an old abandoned railroad town. And she's been living out there for years. And she and my other sister, Renee, started a nonprofit and started an art residency program out there. So you can spend a month in the ghost town and get a little stipend and make art completely, you know, distraction-free out in the desert with a beautiful view of the mountains and lots of ruin at your disposal to use for tools.
And finally, that's a unique environment to do art in. You do most of your work. You're based in Milwaukee. What's it like? What's the Milwaukee environment like for you and your tintype photography and other artistic endeavors?
Milwaukee has been so supportive of what I do. From the residency at the Pfister, I've gotten a lot more people who have heard about me. And so I feel so lucky that I kind of get to make a career out of this very strange process. I feel really lucky about that.
And as we wrap up, when somebody ends up with this cool Civil War looking image of themselves on a piece of metal, what kind of reactions do you get?
Oh, I mean, it's really special for people because this type of image is something that, you know, can be passed down for generations. It's really like an heirloom quality image. And so I get a lot of families, and it is really meaningful for me to see them so happy with their portraits of, you know, kids or whether it be a couple. And so it's really cool to know that these images are going to be in households and be passed down for generations to come.
Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Margaret Musa is a Milwaukee-based wet plate photographer. She was the 2017-2018 artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel and now has her own studio space where she takes tintype photographs. You can see examples of her work at her website, margaretmuza.com. Coming up after the news, are we there yet? We'll look back at the golden age of family road trips. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Let's have a show of hands. How many of you have taken a family road trip? Maybe you remember being crammed into the station wagon, being annoyed by your brother and or sister, dad telling everybody to cut it out, and mom wondering if dad took a wrong turn. There was fast food, sing-alongs, car sickness, car trouble, and a whole bunch of stories to tell when you got back home. While the two-week road trip is pretty much in the past and we've got smartphones and headphones to keep us busy, people are still hitting the roads today. In fact, a survey last year showed that road trips made up 39% of vacations taken by U.S. travelers in 2016. It's up from 17% the previous year. So how did the road trip evolve to what we have today? Rich Rote is an advertising copywriter from Menominee Falls and the author of Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. Rich, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you wrote about the history of the road trip and about your own family's road trips. And I want to get this out there right away. Your dad did, in fact, use the infamous line, "Don't make me pull over."
Oh, all the time. Are you kidding? I had two teenage brothers with me in the back seat, and we caused plenty of problems back there. So he would always, you know, reach that big dad hand over the front seat and try to grab the neck of whoever was stirring up the most trouble. But of course, we knew it was an empty threat because we knew he wasn't about to pull over at any point. My dad was one of those guys, I think like many fathers, who was all about making time on the road, right? He wanted to get to whatever that day's destination was as quickly as humanly possible. So he wasn't about to pull over no matter, you know, what trouble we were getting into in the bag.
Yeah, I was just reading the bit where he wouldn't pull over even if the needle was on E because he was pretty sure there was another 39 miles worth in there.
Yeah, he was absolutely convinced that, you know, automotive engineers kept a reserve of 40 miles worth of gasoline once that low fuel light came on. And I can't tell you, Rob, how many times that got us into, you know, problems out on the highways, especially with a notorious chain of restaurants and kind of snack stands in the South called Stuckey's. Because the thing about Stuckey's was they had about 50 billboards for every location. And, of course, and they also often offered gas. So they would always advertise, you know, great food, great gas at the next Stuckey's. Well, the only problem was in the late 70s, all the Stuckey's started going out of business because they were, you know, kind of victims of the rise of the fast food chains, the McDonald's and the Wendy's and their drive-through windows. But the problem is, when the locations closed, those billboards, of course, would remain up along the highways. So, you know, we'd hit E, no problem. We'd see the billboard for the Stuckey sign, and we'd be following all the billboards to get to that location. The only problem was, of course, when we got to that location, it was closed. It was all boarded up. And so, we often found ourselves in dire straits.
Now, bigger picture, you clearly are nostalgic. You have a very soft spot in your heart for that 1970s-style family road trip in the car.
Absolutely. And it was because it was all about the shared experience back then. It was about making discoveries together as a family. And it wasn't just the good things either. It was the challenges and adversity that you would face along the way. I often say in the book that setting off on a road trip in the 1970s was a lot more like setting off on a great adventure into the wild frontier. There wasn't as much urban sprawl, so the distances between cities felt much greater. There weren't as many exits with service stations that you could find help. And, you know, of course, if you got a flat tire or broke down on the road, help wasn't just a mobile phone call away. Your dad was going to have to go and hitchhike to the nearest exit or somehow, somebody in the car would have to know something about how to fix whatever went wrong with the car.
Rich Rattay is with us. His new book is Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. Well, this was kind of a unique moment in time. And Rich, you write that we take for granted these superhighways that we have and all the services, the availability of gas and lodging and food along the way. Talk about how that all came to be.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the most surprising things to me in doing the initial research for this book was finding out how young America's interstate highway system really is. I mean, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed legislation to begin construction of the interstates in 1956. And of course, it took America basically 2.5 decades to actually build those interstates. So even while we were out traveling the highways and the interstates of the 1970s with my family, they were still building them. And you also consider the list of, just a short list of the things that have been around longer than America's interstate highway system. Color TVs, barcodes, microwave ovens. Queen Elizabeth has been Queen of England longer than America has had its interstate highways. So it's really a young phenomenon. But the interstates had such a profound impact on America. They really changed America in so many ways because they made America, an enormously large country, almost overnight so much smaller. Because once the interstates were constructed, all these destinations and all these places that people wanted to visit could once only read about in newspapers and magazines, suddenly they could travel there, given ownership of a car, a few days off, and a few dollars for gasoline. So it was a fundamental transformation of America.
I was just out at the Henry Ford Museum near Detroit last week, and they've got this great exhibit of the earliest motor hotels, motels, and these little shacks that you could use instead of the tent.
Yeah.
Talk about how we went from, you know, tent carring to hotels.
Yeah, and I just got to say the Henry Ford is just one of my favorite places on earth. It's something that we discovered, my family and I have discovered just in the last five or 10 years or so, and we've been back many times. So highly recommend that place. And, of course, as part of their exhibits, they have a perfectly preserved Holiday Inn motel room, just like you would have found it, like in the 1960s, right? So, you know, the evolution of how we got to motels, basically during the 1920s and 30s, there was kind of a travel boom. People would set out in their cars and basically they would just pull over to the side of the road and camp wherever they found a small clearing or a pleasant spot to stop and spend the evening. Oftentimes they just pull a tent out of the trunk or whatever or sleep in the car. It really wasn't until a man by the name of Charles Kemmons Wilson in the early 1950s set off on his own family road trip with his own six kids and his wife. At that point, Kemmons Wilson had already made millions of dollars as the owner of movie chains and getting into the construction business. But he set off from Memphis to travel to D.C. with his six kids and wife. And he was a man I think my father would have gotten along with. He didn't want to pay the expensive rates charged at downtown hotels. So he was out staying at these little tourist courts, which were basically sets of shacks set up for travelers to stay at. And he found the conditions absolutely deplorable. You know, they were kind of seedy. They attracted a seedy crowd. They weren't a proper place for nice middle-class families to spend an evening. And what's worse, he was charged a surcharge for every single one of his six kids, which cost him more than just the flat fee for the room itself. So he was so shocked and horrified by these conditions that when he got home back to Memphis, he vowed to start his own motel chain that would cater to the needs of family and offer nice basic amenities like a swimming pool and, nice beds and color TVs and air conditioning. And of course, that chain became known as Holiday Inn.
Those things were kind of preconditions for that 70s road trip your family made. And you write at the end, we've lost a lot of that. What is it that kind of didn't completely kill, but put a damper on that long-term family car trip?
Yeah, well, as you pointed out, it seems like millennials and other people really are rediscovering the practical benefits of road travel these days, right? I mean, airfares have gone up significantly in price lately. There's all these unexpected delays and cancellations. You have to get to the airport hours in advance of your flight, especially if you're checking bags. So people are coming back to the road trip once again. But unfortunately, you know, there's also been this rise of technology. And now, especially with personal electronics, everybody has, you know, an iPad where they put on their own headphones and watch their own movies, or they have a smartphone and they're texting with their friends, especially the kids in the back seat. And, you know, mom might be in the passenger seat with her own pair of headphones on and listening to an audiobook. So even though we're getting back to these road trips and we're in our car and we're as close as we ever were, in many ways, we're kind of off in our own little worlds. I think people just have to take that extra effort to also remember that road trips and what made them so magical, it's really about that shared experience and discovering things together and interacting with each other while you travel.
We're talking about the family road trip with Rich Rutte of Menominee Falls. He's the author of Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. And we want to hear from you. Have you taken a road trip with the family or perhaps survived one? Where'd you go? What kind of vehicle did you take? What did you listen to? Have you done a similar trip with your own kids? Are you planning on taking one this summer? Share a story or a memory with us. Tweet us at Central Time WPR with your story. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. We continue our conversation on the Great American Road Trip with Rich Rutte, author of Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. On his playlist, he says, Convoy by C.W. McCall is a truly terrible song. What? But it is what inspired people to start referring to state troopers as Smokies and confirming dinner plans with a 10-4 good buddy. So what did you listen to on your road trips? Did you take road trips with the family? What happened? Where'd you go? What kind of car did you take? And do you still take road trips today, or do you avoid them, if at all possible?
Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Bonus points for photos.
We'll go right to your calls now. Gretchen is with us in Manitowoc. Gretchen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the conversation and bringing back all the crazy memories of a family road trip. Can't wait to read the book. But no, it brought back, I'm the youngest of four, and we would always travel to Ohio every summer in a Astro minivan in the early 80s. And my brother and I and my sisters, we would kill each other by the end of the trip. In fact, there was one year where my sister, one of my sisters was on crutches, and my other sister was strangling her as we were going to get gas at one of the way stations.
She wasn't on crutches because of injuries sustained during the road trip, I hope.
No.
Good.
No.
Good. But it sounds like fond memories, Gretchen. Wow. Youngest of four, Rich. Does that ring a bell for you?
Yeah, it sure does. I think we had some similar experiences there. But you know what? Sometimes it's a lot of that adversity and some of the bickering and squabbling that ultimately really brings you together. When I look at my brothers and sister, we're such different people. We're in different careers. But we also have an incredibly strong bond. And I credit that bond to those long hours that we spent, traveling the highways of America together during the 1970s.
Gretchen, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Jen in La Crosse. Jen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Jen?
So I'm on a road trip with my two kids. We started in Illinois, went out to the Black Hills, and now we're headed back. So I think what you were talking about with kids and devices and stuff like that is kind of true. It seems like it would be cruel to make them kind of tough out the entire road trip. So we do an hour on with the screens and then an hour where we're talking and doing whatever. So.
Okay. I like that. Jen, thanks a lot for that call. And Rich, I got to say, we took a family road trip. This is a couple of years ago with early teenagers to New Orleans. And there were times I was very glad that they had their phones with their own music on it.
Oh, absolutely. As much as a road trip should be about family interaction, we also all need our own little downtime at times, too, right?
Definitely. Thanks, Jen, for that call. And now I think you're a parent yourself now, Rich. Are you able to recreate the highlights of your family road trips?
Well, I learned some things from my dad, and there's some things, that I do a little bit differently as well. As I said earlier, my dad was all about making time, so we would never stop at all these interesting roadside attractions and things along the way, and I'm much more prone as the dad these days to make those stops, to take time and discover some of these interesting things that you can find along the way. On a recent road trip that we took out to Yellowstone, we stopped off at the Field of Dreams in Iowa, a few hours to the west in Clear Lake, Iowa. We stopped off at the Surf Ballroom, which is the venue that Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and the Big Bopper last played at before boarding, that fateful airplane and crashing into a nearby cornfield. And we stopped off at some of those traditional places like the Corn Palace and Wall Drug. My dad would have never have done that.
Thanks a lot for that call. Anna is with us now in Beloit. Anna, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to tell you about the road trip that I'm on right now with my friend Sylvie. We're millennials and we're not just listening to our headphones. So we thought you might think this is interesting.
Well, you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, so that's a good step.
Yeah, thanks. I've been road tripping for just about 2 months now, and I'm almost home, but it's been awesome. We've been doing all those same stops that your last caller was just talking about. We've been to, I think, 7 or 8 national parks and lots of funny roadside attractions, but we're not just watching movies or anything. My friend here is crocheting right now, so we're trying to do it the old-fashioned way as much as possible, doing lots of tent camping and all that good stuff.
Fantastic, Anna. Thank you so much, Anna and her friend. I think she had 2 months on this road trip, Rich. That's another, you focus on the family road trip, but that the buddy road trip, the Thelma and Louise, but hopefully without the tragic ending road trip.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Those buddy road trips can be just as rewarding, and I certainly took my share, especially heading down to spring break, Daytona Beach back in the day with, at that time, we probably had 6 or 7 of my buddies in the car.
Thanks a lot for the call, Anna. We are talking about road trips, mostly the family road trip. Rich Rote is with us. He's from Menominee Falls. His new book is Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. Back to your calls now. Joe is with us in Ontario, Wisconsin. Joe, hi.
Hi. Great topic. Fun topic.
Yeah, what'd you want to tell us about, Joe?
Well, after my dad passed away back in the middle 60s, my mother took us on a road trip. We went out from Pennsylvania all the way out to Reno, Nevada. And, you know, as an adult, that was 50 years ago. I could close my eyes, picture all the different stops, the Stuckeys along the way, and riding in the back of the old Chevy station wagon with the back window down, the back seat faced backwards. And, you know, the kids were moving their arms up and down to try to get the truckers to beep their horns. And, you know, it's just something that will always stay with me. And, you know, it was a precious time in my life, and it kind of got me through a really difficult time after my dad passed. So family road trips are really precious.
Joe, thank you so much. What a great story. Thank you so much for sharing that. Rich, these are powerful memories that can stick with people, especially if it's at a particular time in your life like it was for Joe.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's part of what I hope people get out of my book is, of course, that it stirs up some fun memories of their own. Of course, you know, I share some of my own family stories and recollections and observations while traveling the highways as an 8 or 10 year old at that time. But I also hope that what people will find interesting in the book is the history about how those experiences came to be and, you know, how we got things like CB radios and AAA triptychs and why our station wagons had fake wood paneling on the side. It's all in there.
Thanks a lot for that call. I won't spoil all your stories from the book, though, Rich. And I want to bring on another caller now. Karen is with us in Washburn County. Karen, hi.
Hi. Well, our family took road trips. They might have not involved the interstate. We lived on a dairy farm, and we could only go for a day because we had to get back home to milk the cows. But we take the country roads, especially in the fall, to view the leaves in the Blue Hills north of Weyerhaeuser. And I can remember my aunt was with us, and my mom and dad, and my sister and family, and we were raising too much cane in the back seat. And, yeah, my dad threatened, don't make me stop, and he did.
He did? And then what happens next when Dad actually does stop?
We had to get out of the car, and they left us out on a country road for about 20 minutes by ourselves to get things straight and figure out how we had to behave. And then they came back around the corner slowly to pick us up.
And, Karen, you learned your lesson and never made trouble again, right?
Yeah.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing that. And Rich, for people doing it back then or even doing it now, it doesn't have to be that, you know, multi-week extravaganza.
Oh, absolutely not. And what we're seeing about with road trippers today is that they are taking more of those long weekend style of road trip vacations. And honestly, that's what I do with my own family these days, too. We talked about, you know, going to the Henry Ford Museum. That was just a long weekend for us. Going to places like St. Louis. They have that beautiful city museum down there. Another one of my favorite places to go. So, you know, even a trip of, you know, a couple, 3 days can be just a, you know, a great getaway.
Rich, as we start to wrap up, do you have a road trip planned or maybe the dream road trip you still want to do?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, especially for somebody who's now written a book about road trips, I would really like to trace the original route of Route 66. Ooh. And also the Lincoln Highway, which I write about extensively in my book as well. Of course, the Lincoln Highway was America's first transcontinental highway.
How long would you need to set aside for a trip like that?
Yeah, I would think if you're driving from Times Square to San Francisco and you want to do it right, I would think, you know, probably 7 days in each direction.
And, Rich, you're not going to find the Stuckeys on Times Square or in San Francisco, I don't think. I mean, I can't confirm that.
Right. Stuckey's does live on there. I think there's about 30 or 35 locations still out there, but not anywhere near the 400 or so locations that there once were.
I was always partial to the Howard Johnson's candy selection. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
You bet, Rob. Thank you for having me on. I had fun, too.
Rich Rote is an advertising copywriter from Menominee Falls and the author of Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. You can keep the conversation going over on Twitter. What is the best or at least most memorable family road trip that you've been part of? Maybe you did one with friends. What stands out in your memory? Would you do it again? Tweet us at Central Time WPR with your stories and road trip memories. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, more than 100,000 Americans die every year because of air pollution, and around that world, the number is over 7 million annually. We'll look at where that pollution comes from and how to cut back on it. And sharing a meal is a great way to build community. We'll hear about a program in Milwaukee that brings together people from diverse backgrounds to the same dinner table. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7:30, Senator Tammy Baldwin joins host John Munson to talk about Washington politics and Wisconsin issues, and she's taking your calls about what's important to you. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, when you think of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, what comes to mind? We'll talk to the author of Upper Talk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.